Today on Rock in the Suburbs.
A little bit of vomit came up into my mouth.
Welcome back to Black Sabbath Week here on Rock in the Suburbs. I am Mike Coley. We are pretty much in the middle of Black Sabbath Week here. It's myself and Stephen Routledge.
Yeah, hi Mike.
Carrying on with our week-long takeover tradition of the Suburbs pod, where previous times we've broken down Metallica, we've broken down Iron Maiden. Now it's time for the Godfathers of Heavy Metal. We are in day three, and we're about to get deep into it here.
We are, well, yeah, I mean, we are, Mike, and it's, yeah, it's always a pleasure to be talking with you, mate, and talking metal with you. And we left things off yesterday with the second album of the Ronnie James Dio era, which, whilst not quite as good as the first, was still very good. And, yeah, so things are set fair for the 80s then, Mike. Black Sabbath are rejuvenated with a new singer. They're putting out great music, so what could possibly go wrong?
Exactly.
Pretty much everything, more or less. So, the problems start. There's the old classic creative tensions between Tony and Ronnie and Geezer. And it all comes down to the mixing of, I think it was the Live Evil album.
Mm-hmm.
That... basically, Tony and Geezer say that Ronnie was going in at night after they'd gone home and altering the mix and turning down the bass and guitars and turning up the drums and vocals. And Ronnie's like, no, I wasn't doing that. And yeah, it's hard to know exactly what was happening. I tend to defer to Mick Wall and his excellent biography, Simpsons of the Universe, because he's a... One, he was working for the band in a PR capacity for some time, probably as a journalist, but also he points out that Ronnie, one, he didn't do drugs. I mean, he liked a herbal cigarette and a drink, but he wasn't into the hard drugs like Tony was still doing copious amounts of cocaine. And he wasn't a night owl. So he, you know, Mick Wall makes the point that the idea that Ronnie was sneaking in late at night to order mix doesn't really fit with the character and lifestyle of Ronnie James Dio, so...
doesn't jive.
No, so whatever happened, basically, Ronnie leaves, Vinny goes with him, and Live Evil gets released with them deliberately crediting him as Ronnie Dio rather than Ronnie James Dio on the album, just to twist the knife on the way out, but... they won't be laughing for too long. So they're back to where they were when after Ozzy left, and after a meeting stroke drinking session in a pub with Ian Gillan, who of Deep Purple, and Gillan retrospectively says he can't really recall much of this meeting or indeed agreeing to joining, but he gets a call from his agent or manager the next day saying, if you're going to join a band, please let me know, because apparently you joined Black Sabbath yesterday. that's a way to wake up from a hangover, isn't it? Oh, apparently I just joined Black Sabbath. But, you know, at this point, you know, Ozzy left, they got another well-established singer in with an impressive vocal range, and it worked pretty well. So they head into the studio with Ian Gillan. We get an album called Born Again. Bill rejoins for this before leaving after the album is completed because he doesn't want to tour. And a long time Tony Iommi friend, a guy called Bev Bevan of The Move and ELO, comes in on drums for the tour, which is a bit weird having the drummer from ELO playing on the Black Sabbath tour.
Yeah, when I read that, I was very, very, very struck.
Yeah, it's good. I know he's very close friends with Tony back from the Birmingham days. In fact, he does the audiobook version of Tony's autobiography, which is a bit weird when Ben Bevan is reading bits quoting Tony talking about Ben Bevan. but anyway, that's...
He needed the money.
Yeah. We can't put it off, Mike. We're going to have to talk about the album Born Again.
Yeah.
We said Sabotage wasn't their worst album cover. Here it is.
There it is. If this was a video podcast, you would be cringing at the screen looking at this album. If you're not familiar with this era, this is what, 1983?
83, yeah. 83 this comes out, yeah.
Yeah, so Ian Gillan joins the band. And originally, it wasn't even supposed to be a Black Sabbath project. It was supposed to be a super group build to the individual members.
Yeah.
Arden wanted it to be a Sabbath album. And so it became a Sabbath album in name.
No, it didn't, Mike. No, it didn't.
In name. It became a Sabbath album in name.
Yeah. Legally, it's a Black Sabbath album. But I'm just going to read you my notes, Mike. Because...
Fire away. Brutally honest.
I mean, it's just awful. No matter how often Ian Gillan unleashes his child in time whale. I mean, let's not forget, Ian Gillan is a really good rock singer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's not good. He's just not good on this album. And as you said, it wasn't supposed to have been a Sabbath album. But that's not the only thing that's wrong with it. I mean, the guitar tone is like appallingly thick. Play this back to back. Play Born Again back to back with Master of Reality. It's like, is this the same guy playing guitar? I mean, the whole thing just sounds like a pale imitation of the bands that they inspired. I mean, Digital Bitch, which is a terrible song title. It sounds like something Spinal Tap would write, who we shall return to very, very shortly while talking about this album. not only is it an awful title, it's just a bad rewrite of Highway Star.
Yeah, I'm surprised that he had as much say in the songwriting on this album as he did. So it's just not Sabbath material.
It's not. Hotline sounds like Motley Crue.
Mm-hmm.
But they saved the worst till last, Mike. A song called Keep It Warm. And I kid you not, a little bit of vomit came up into my mouth when listening to Keep It Warm. I mean, there was carrot chunks. I mean, it was bad, man.
Oh, shouldn't have had that soup.
The lyrics are just like, what is happening? This is... And also, but musically, Tony sounds like he's trying to compete with Randy Rhoads at this point, trying to shred more, and which he can't do. That's not his thing. He can't out-shred Randy Rhoads. Most people can't.
No.
Lyrically, it reminds me a bit, although this wasn't anything like as bad as Born Again, is when Queen and Paul Rodgers teamed up. Like, Paul Rodgers is a great singer. Queen are a great band. Paul Rodgers shouldn't have been nowhere near Queen.
Yeah.
Because he is like blue collar, meat and potatoes, soul and rock. They need, what they actually ended up getting with. The guy they should have got was George Michael.
Now that would have been a good...
Because, you listen back to the Freddie Mercury tribute concert album, and when someone did Find Someone to Love with George Michael, it's like, I thought at the time, man, if they're going to keep going, they need to get George, because he's perfect, because he could bring the campness and the operaticness and all that stuff to it. Anyway, that's a side note. But yeah, but it's like that when they mix take two people from two great bands, put them together, and you get, but this is just awful. It's just so, so bad.
So I don't remember if I've even, I know I have a copy of it on CD somewhere, but I first heard this version of Sabbath. It was a compilation album. I forget what it was called. It was some KTEL type thing, and it just it was supposed to be like the Masters of Metal or something like that, and the lead track on that cassette was trashed from this album. So I don't know if they just couldn't get the rights to anything else from Sabbath or what, but trashed was the lead track on this Masters of Metal compilation that I had.
A little bit of normative determinism there, Mike.
What's that?
A little bit of normative determinism, yeah, there, yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, again, going back to when I was talking with Justin about the Dylan Hall of Fame, and I mentioned my loathing for the Eric Clapton album Pilgrim, which is just, I mean, it's bad, but it's just blandly bad. Whereas Born Again is offensively bad.
Yeah.
I mean, never mind Firing It Into the Sea or Firing It Into the Sun. What you should do with that copy of Born Again, Mike, is get that copy. Don't fire it out of a cannon. Put it in a cannon. Then strap that cannon to one of the South African arseholes exploding rockets and fire that into the sun. That's that is what that album is good for. It is by far their worst album. I mean, we've still got some depths to plumb, but...
Well, Gillan even says that he was the absolute worst lead singer that Sabbath ever had.
I mean, it's just wrong. It's just the wrong singer for him. Yeah, it was... Oh, it's just... Yeah, we're not going to play anything from it, folks, because we don't... I don't want to inflict that on you. It's... I mean, if you thought us playing something from St. Anger on Metallica Week was bad, if we played you something from Born Again, you'd probably never speak to us again. It's just awful. Absolutely horrendous. But we also have to mention the tour for this album. And because there is a song on Born Again called Stonehenge, isn't there, Mike?
Yes. Track number 2.
And for the stage show for this, they thought that perhaps they should have a Stonehenge replica on stage. Now, all the listeners now at this point will be thinking, hang on, this sounds awfully familiar. And guess what? Yes, that is indeed where the inspiration for the Spinal Tap micro Stonehenge comes from. However,
which is amazing in itself, because the movie was being made around the same time that this album tour happened.
I do wonder if, because of what happened at the end of the tour when they had to dispose of the stage set, I think it ended up in the sea, ironically, which is where the album should have gone as well. but Sabbath had the opposite problem, because they made a one-to-one replica of the actual Stonehenge. Yes. Which is huge.
And touring with this replica that wouldn't fit in most buildings.
They could barely fit it into most venues, yes. And so, yeah, somehow news of this got back to the makers of Spinal Tap, and the inverse relationship was created with, I mean, if that tells you, that just basically tells you everything about how bad this album is. Just don't listen to it, folks, please. If you do, on your own heads be it. We've warned you.
Duly warned.
Yes, indeed. Forewarned and is forearmed. So, anyway, that tour comes to an end. Ian Gillan goes off to rejoin Deep Purple and make the Perfect Strangers record. At this point, we get a guy called David Donato comes in on vocals, who was, if I remember rightly, it was a male model. And I think Keezer and Tony thought, well, if he can sing as well as he looks good, we're set. Only problem was he couldn't and didn't.
Didn't work out so well.
So despite him being announced as the new singer of Black Sabbath, Bill rejoins at this point, but then David Donato is fired. Bill leaves again, and then Geezer leaves, all in 1984. So it's quite the year.
The revolving door continues.
Indeed. So we don't get any new music, but given what's just happened, that's probably not a bad thing. And neither do we get anything new music in 1985. Although the original lineup do reform to play at Live Aid in Philadelphia, although that wasn't originally the plan. Sharon Osbourne, as she was now by this point, had wanted to get Ozzy onto the bill as a solo artist, but apparently Geldof said no. But when he said, well, what if we get the original Sabbath line up together? He said, yeah, that'll do. And so they play at Philadelphia. Although, if you watch the footage, I'm guessing the old Bolivian marching powder had been deployed quite extensively before they went on stage.
It was pretty early set for them, too.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently it was quite awkward backstage because none of them were talking to each other. And anyway, so 1985 comes and goes. So it was 1984. And we head into 1986. And I hope you can keep up here, folks, because we get Dave Spitz of Great White on bass guitar and Eric Singer of Alice Cooper, Lita Ford and Kiss and others on drums. And because it worked so well last time with a former Deep Purple singer,
yeah,
Tony hooks up with a guy who's also another great singer, Glenn Hughes. Much like Born Again, this was supposed to be a Naomi Glenn Hughes sort of solo duo project, but the record company say no, there's more money to be made by it being a Black Sabbath album. So bizarrely, it comes out as a Black Sabbath featuring Tony Iommi is how it's billed. And the album's called Seventh Star.
It's about a 2-star.
I mean, I've got here, and I'm sure Joe Fleisch would appreciate it, this is yet more false metal after Born Again. I mean, the band that created heavy metal was giving us a second dose of, or third or fourth, depending if you count Tekla Ecstasy and Never Say Die, of false metal. But as an 80s hard rock album, it actually serves its purpose. And it's not as unpleasant to listen to as Born Again. And Glenn Hughes has got an amazing voice.
He does.
They're very different to Ronnie, but he's an amazing singer. But it's not metal, and it's not really Black Sabbath. I think to demonstrate the point, Mike, we should have a little listen to No Stranger to Love from the Seventh Star album. Just not because I'm saying it's great, just because...
At the Glenn Hughes.
Yeah, appreciate where we're at and how far we've fallen. Sorry, this is not Bon Jovi week, folks.
Oh.
This is Black Sabbath week still. Don't worry. We are in Black Sabbath week, but you might have thought for a moment you were in Bon Jovi week.
It almost sounded, had a little Michael Bolton feel to it.
Yes. Well, Michael Bolton enters the Black Sabbath story as well.
Yeah, he's part briefly. Of it.
Really, folks, seriously, but, well, not so seriously, but, yeah, I mean, everything, yeah, it's just 80s power ballad. I mean,
it just fits right in with that era of music, and blandly so.
Glenn Hughes, he sounds awesome. His voice is awesome. But that's not Black Sabbath or metal. That's just, you know, and yeah, it's a very patchy album, but there is stuff to enjoy on there, and it's a lot better than Born Again. But that's like saying dropping a one pound weight on your foot is better than dropping a 3 pound weight on your foot. Still hurts, just not as much. but unbelievably, they go out on tour for this. Glenn Hughes gets fired midway through the tour. And I hope you're sitting down, folks, for having a cocaine habit that is too much even for Tony Iommi. Which is kind of hard to believe. I mean, that's like, yeah, it's, yeah, I'm out of time. I can't even put it into words how ridiculous that is, but but anyway, so Glenn Hughes is out midway through the tour. A guy called Ray Gillen with an E rather than A, no relation to Ian Gillen, comes in to finish the tour. Dave Spitz, who, if you lost track, folks, is on bass guitar at this point, he leaves during rehearsals for the next album, and a guy called Bob Daisley comes in on bass, who has played in lots of other bands.
From Ozzy's band.
Famously in the Blizzard of Oz band, and also wrote the lyrics for the Blizzard of Oz album. That all happens in 1986, and we move into 1987, and Ray Gillen leaves during the recording, taking drummer Eric Singer with him to join a guy called Jake E. Lee, who's just been fired from Ozzy's band. To form a
Badland.
So they've got no singer, they've got no drummer. Bob Daisley leaves to join Gary Moore, along with, at this point, singer. And so Bev Bevan briefly comes back in on drums.
And then they find Tony Martin.
They find a guy called Tony Martin who comes in to be the singer. But Bev Bevan leaves when Tony agrees to play Sun City in South Africa. Terry Chimes, who was briefly in The Clash, comes in on drums. I hope you're keeping up, folks.
The tree expands.
Can you see why we had to have a spreadsheet, folks? And then Dave Spitz comes back on bass guitar. I need to leave again and be replaced by a guy called Joe Burt for the tour. Tony Martin, so as you've mentioned, Mike, comes in on vocals, having ironically co-written Valley of the Kings and allegedly much more of the debut Blue Murder album with John Sykes, who was formerly of Whitesnake and Tigers of Pantang and Thin Lizzy, and who basically wrote the music for the 1987 Whitesnake album, which obviously was a massive hit. And yeah, so yes, folks, he's the guy who wrote Still of the Night, and for that he will be forever remembered in greatness, because that's just one of the greatest hard rock songs ever. And you can understand why guys were leaving to join John Sykes in Blue Murder, because he was red hot at this point, and the Blue Murder project was highly touted within industry. The album actually doesn't live up, going back to it now, it's nothing like as good as I remembered.
Yeah, I was really into it when it came out, but yeah, I tried to listen to it again.
Yeah, I listened to it again, and yeah, Valley of the Kings is still great, but it's just a rewrite of Still of the Night, which, if you're the guy who wrote Still of the Night, you can write your own version of it, and that's fair enough, you know. But with that, in 1987, we get Eternal Idol, which you say is the first album with a guy called Tony Martin, who had been in bands, but none of the stature of previous guys like Glenn Hughes and Ian Gillan and Ronnie James Dio beforehand. Yeah, the first show that Tony Martin plays with them is at Sun City in South Africa, which, surprisingly, does not go down well with a lot of other artists.
So Tony seemed to be pretty oblivious to why people weren't playing Sun City.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, again, he was still heavily medicating, let's put it that way. I think his justification was they gave him a lot of money. I mean, apparently they bought him a Rolls Royce just for signing the contract. Okay. We get the record Eternal Idol, the record absolutely bombs, and the record labels on both sides of the Atlantic drop Black Sabbath. At the same time as this, Don Arden, who we've referred to as being a piece of work, finally goes too far, gets arrested for kidnap and torture, and let's say the details are quite gruesome, folks, so I will not spare that here, but he is found guilty. But because he gets rich man's justice and skates without any jail time, his son takes the fall, basically, and goes to jail for this. And that's the end of Don Arden, pretty much, as a music manager and certainly in the career of Black Sabbath, who, being without a record label, and I hope folks are sitting down for this, who do they sign with, Mike?
Who did they sign with? Vertigo?
Nope. IRS.
Oh, yeah.
So REM and Black Sabbath.
They're on the same label.
Oh, on the same label in 1987.
Maybe that's what pushed REM to go to Warner Brothers.
Yeah, they're like, hang on a minute. You can't make this stuff up, really. And, yeah, so we get the Eternal Idol album, which, say, doesn't do very well. And, I mean, it's completely forgettable, Mike. I don't know about you. It's...
I honestly can't even recommend a song from that one because I've only maybe listened to it once.
Yeah, I mean, there's a song on there called Hard Life to Love. Again, we're still in the 80s, so...
Got to sing about love.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. The title track is basically the only half-decent thing on there, really. But it's just so underwhelming. And, I mean, Tony Martin, and he turns out to be the longest-serving singer of Black Sabbath, ironically. But he doesn't have the charisma of Ozzy, and he doesn't have the power and range of a Dio or a Glenn Hughes. And he just comes across as like a pound shot Ronnie James Dio to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I could sing as well as Tony Martin, I'd be ecstatic. You know, because he can sing really well. The problem is he can't sing as well as Ronnie James Dio. And he hasn't got anything like the stage presence, charisma, or anguish of Ozzy. And as we've established, that's what you need.
Yeah, that was a big part of his whole thing, was his stage presence just wasn't there. And, you know, you could probably attribute to him not being in bigger bands like Ronnie was, or like Glenn Hughes was, or Gillan.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Whilst those albums, with certainly the last two guys, didn't work out, they knew how to command a stage because they'd done it before they were in Black Sabbath, you know, that was never in doubt. So I think the only other thing of note is that Brian May plays a guitar solo on the track When Death Calls, but that's not enough to recommend listening to it. And I suppose the only other thing we can mention that shows how little they learned is that for the album cover of The Eternal Idol, they wanted to recreate a famous Rodin sculpture of two people kissing. So they got two models to reenact it and spray painted them with paint so they looked like they were bronze. And guess what? They also got ill.
Didn't we go through this once before?
Yeah, Tony, haven't we been here already? But again, like we said, kids, don't do coke because you'll do stupid things. Fortunately, they didn't nearly die, but they were hospitalized. So, so at this point, we're in 1988. Black Sabbath are signed with IRS, and we get Cozy Powell enters the picture, who is a very good, excellent rock drummer. Probably, again, quick to list who Cozy Powell hasn't played with, Mike, wouldn't it?
Yeah, he's played with just about everybody in the hard rock metal world, I think.
Yeah, just a very good drummer. And we've still got keyboard player Jeff Nichols there. But one thing about Cozy Powell is that he can interact with Tony as an equal. You know, Tony can't bully Cozy Powell, and actually they get on quite well. So I think, you know, there's quite a good sort of musical marriage between Cozy and Tony Iommi. And so in 1989 we get the album Headless Cross, which I mentioned back on the beginning, when that was my sort of introduction to Black Sabbath, with Neil Murray, formerly of Whitesnake, and Gary Moore on bass guitar at this point. And it's better than Eternal Idol, I'll say that. I think it leans far too heavily on the sort of early occult tropes, of particularly the debut album, and is also still very 80s metal, but not in a good way, not in the sort of Maiden, Metallica, Slayer vein, but more in the sort of pop metal disaster kind of way.
Agree.
Yeah, so we'll play some stuff from this Tony Martin era, but I think we'll maybe go on to the next album, which comes out the following year, actually, in 1990, an album called Tear, which is sort of a Nordic legend-themed album. I think it benefits a little bit from that, of getting away from them trying to sort of recreate what Black Sabbath was and try and do something a bit fresher. And I think Tony Martin's voice sounds better than this on the first two. And yeah, if I had to pick one of the Tony Martin albums, it would probably be this one.
Yeah, it's kind of going into, Tony Martin has a little bit more influence on the writing. That's where he's getting into this Nordic mythology type stuff, which kind of parallels, Ronnie's Demons and Wizards type stuff.
Yeah, it's the best. Let's play it. We'll play a little bit of maybe the Sabbath Stones, if that's right, Mike, just to give people a taste of what the Tony Martin version of Black Sabbath sounds like.
Yeah.
Kind of hear it there, can't you, Mike, with Tony Martin's vocals? Like, he can hit all the notes,
yeah,
and but it's a facsimile of Ronnie, isn't it?
He's trying. He's got that little raspiness that isn't Ronnie, but you could tell he's trying to, pull some of that Ronnie feel into the music.
He hasn't got the richness of the tone and the vibrato that just Ronnie just like. I mean, not many people do, full stop. If I had to pick one of the Tony Martin albums, it would probably be that one. It's certainly better than what we've had before. But for the first time in 1990, Black Sabbath don't tour the United States, because they basically, they don't want to play small venues. Yeah, then they just can't sell the tickets. Yeah, think back to the early 70s, and they were one of the biggest live draws, full stop. Other than Led Zeppelin, they were right up there with anyone else, and now they're not even bothering to tour America, which shows just how much the constant personnel changes and sort of the tarnishing of the legacy is hurt,
And good on them for recognizing it, at least, and not wasting the money to come to the States.
Yes,
to play in front of half-filled theaters.
So at this point, Neil Murray on bass and Tony Martin are both fired, and we'll get to why when we touch on Ronnie's career more on day five. But Ronnie's, James Dio's career is on a little bit of a downturn, and well, it worked before. Let's get Ronnie back. So Ronnie comes back, Geezer comes back, but Cozy Powell gets injured in a horse riding accident in another Spinal Tap echo of drumming casualties. Although this isn't, he doesn't die.
And as Tony said, it turned out to be a fortunate incident or a fortunate accident for the band because Cozy didn't really want to perform with Ronnie anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Ronnie and Cozy did not get on. So Vinny actually comes back in. And so we've basically got the Heaven and Hell Mob Rules, or we've got the Mob Rules lineup back for the next album, which comes in 1992, which is called Dehumanizer. And what's your thoughts on Dehumanizer, Mike?
Not awful. TV Crimes is probably the standout track for me on that one.
Uh-huh.
Kind of talks about evangelists. Stealing money from their followers.
Yeah, a bit like Ozzy's Miracle Man in some ways.
Yeah,
I agree with you. Yeah, it's not as good as the first two Ronnie albums. It's nowhere near as good. But I do really like the track "I." I think that's you could slot that onto, you know, either of those first two albums. And I think it would hold its place. I think it's a really, really good track. "I." Yeah, the rest of the album is not, the magic's not quite there that this time. Although the fans kind of, this did sell significantly better than anything since.
Yeah, they at least they charted pretty decently with this one. You know, top 30 in the UK, top 45. Yeah. It was number 44 in the US.
Yeah, given they were having like top 10 albums in the heyday, you know, I mean, yes, it's success of a sort, but it's pretty small fish compared to where they were. But things are about to get even more crazy. So they go on a tour to support this. And again, we'll cover this in far more depth than when we get to Ozzy tomorrow. Ozzy announces his retirement in 1992, and there's the No More Tours tour. We're culminating with two farewell shows in California, at which the plan is for Black Sabbath to play at those shows, and just to basically play before Ozzy and then come on with Ozzy for a couple of numbers at the end. But Ronnie James Dio says, to quote, "I'm not opening for an effing clown," and leaves. which means Sabbath are due to play, but they don't have a singer. And when they arrive for these shows, this is something that will become significant later on, Tony gets arrested and put in prison for non-payment of child maintenance for one of his many wives and his daughter. So that gets resolved in a way which is mixed versions of. Some say that the record label got the money together, others that Sharon fixed it because she needed Black Sabbath to play at the shows.
That's the version that Geezer recounts.
Yes. Yeah, Tony doesn't recount that one, but Geezer does. What we do know for certain is at some point in the 90s, Tony loses the rights to call himself Black Sabbath exclusively. And yeah, one of the versions is that basically that was the deal with Sharon for basically bailing him out, because basically they didn't have any money, didn't have enough money to post the bail, basically. And that Sharon basically bailed him out in return for you have to give up the rights to Black Sabbath. But this doesn't happen immediately, so again, it's all a bit cloudy. Anyway, they play the farewell shows with Ozzy with some guy called Rob Halford. Ever heard of him, Mike?
Don't know him.
Just some random guy they found on the street. I mean, if you can't get Ronnie James Dio,
you may as well get the metal god.
Rob Halford's not a bad substitute, is he, really? So, yeah, so they... Yeah, they play those shows, and obviously Ozzy retires at that point, so we'll cover that in more depth. But as, and so Ronnie's already left, so they've got no singer. Vinnie leaves to go back to play with Ronnie, and a guy called Bobby Rondinelli, also formerly of Rainbow, comes in on drums, and Tony Martin comes back in on vocals. And we get another album in 1994 called Cross Purposes. It starts decently, but then falls apart terribly.
I honestly, I don't know if I've ever listened to this one. I know I should have leading up to this week.
I mean, I stepped up, mate. I put my ears on the line for you. I listened to it and...
Appreciate your service.
It starts okay, but I mean, there's a track called A Virtual Death, which is, I mean, literally, that's what I felt like listening to it. It's just interminable. You know, it just feels like I was dying listening to it. And then there's a song called Dying for Love. I mean...
Because why not?
Just awful. We're not in the 80s anymore. But
keep that 80s thing going in the 90s.
So they go out on tour. Bobby Rondinelli quits near the end of the tour. Bill Ward comes back in for a few shows. But then Geezer leaves again. And Bill follows Geezer out the door again. And Neil Murray and Cozy Powell come back. Probably wishing they didn't, because the album we get the following year in 1995 is, well, again, talking about normative determinism, the album's called Forbidden, and it should be, Mike, shouldn't it, really? It just...
It should have been forbidden from being recorded.
Oh, it's just bad. They get Ernie C of Body Count to produce this. They try to bring sort of the at that time current alternative rock influences into it. I mean, we've got rap in there.
Yeah, Ice-T even makes a guest appearance on that one.
It doesn't make it good, though.
No.
There's a song on there called Sick and Tired, and it sounds like a bad version of Black Velvet.
Is there a good version of Black Velvet?
Well, no, but it's a worse version is what I'm trying to say.
Sorry.
It's just really bad. I mean, this is a band that invented heavy metal, and yeah. It's so bad, in fact, Mike, that basically that's it in terms of Black Sabbath being a band that Tony Iommi is in.
Yeah, they were touring clubs.
Yeah, the same year, Geezer releases his first out solo album called GZR. Well, I could play something from that, actually, because that I described that as it's impressively oppressive. In that it's like really heavy, like seriously heavy. It's called Plastic Planet, and it has Fear Factory's Burton C. Bell on the vocals, and it's just really, really heavy, and it's certainly better than Forbidden. There's a song on there called Giving Up the Ghost, which Geezer apparently wrote about Tony and the sort of the continuing attempts to limp on with Black Sabbath and Forbidden. So maybe let's have a little snippet of that so folks can hear what that sounds like. You bastard!
it's definitely heavy.
Yeah, and it's certainly better than this last two Sabbath albums.
Yeah, and it's obvious that Geezer's got his finger on the pulse of what's going on at that point in time. Mid-90s or whatever, and, you know, it's definitely of that era, what you were hearing on, say, like the Ozfest bill, you know? Those types of bands.
Talking of which, Mike, nicely queued up. As we sort of mentioned previously, at this point, Tony no longer has exclusive use of the Black Sabbath name. And in 1997, is that year again? We get the announcement that the original lineup is going to get back together and tour for Ozfest, which comes about because Perry Farrell doesn't think Ozzy's cool enough to be on Lollapalooza. So Sharon decides to start her own roving metal festival, and Ozfest is born. Although we don't get Bill Ward back on drums, we get Mike Borden, who was playing in Ozzy's band, was also from Faith No More, on drums for these tours. Bill comes back for the two Birmingham shows, which are recorded and then released as the reunion album, along with a couple of new studio tracks. That comes out in the following year, 1998. So they're now back touring as the original Black Sabbath, although in 1998 Bill has a heart attack on tour. Vinny comes back to fill in. Bill comes back, but with Vinny on standby because they're not sure if Bill's going to last. Bill's not too thrilled about this. So they're touring again, but there's no, other than the two new songs that's on Reunion, which are okay. They're not, I don't think they're particularly stellar, but they're fine. Certainly better than anything in the recent Sabbath past.
Yeah.
But we get a few more tours with Ozfest alternating with just Ozzy on himself. But in 2001, it's mooted that there's going to be a new album with the original lineup, with Rick Rubin producing. And so they meet up with Rick. It doesn't go well.
It didn't really hit it off.
No, they're not impressed by Rick. Probably because at that time, he's the Red Hot producer. And I think the opinion was that can he help them rediscover the magic? That all fizzles out. So we get a few more Ozfest tours with the original lineup until 2007, when we get a compilation put out of the Dio years of Sabbath, and that leads to that lineup reforming. But as we've covered, they can't call themselves Black Sabbath anymore, which, as you said, alluded to earlier, Mike. Yeah, they probably should have maybe done at the time. Called themselves something different when Ronnie joined, because it was such a different sound.
Yeah.
So they take the name of that first album, Heaven and Hell, and play some shows.
I got to see them on this tour. It's the only time I've ever seen any incarnation of Black Sabbath.
Oh, wow. And was it good? Because my understanding was the reaction was phenomenal.
Yeah, I loved it. I'd seen Ronnie perform a few times with his solo band.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing him on stage doing the Sabbath songs that he, Heaven and Hell and Neon Nights, those songs, seeing him perform them with the Heaven and Hell band, or the Mob Rules band, I guess, it was fantastic. I loved it.
Yeah, I imagine that must have been grand, because, it goes well, and they're extremely well received. But Bill leaves, and Vinny obviously comes back in on drums, so we get the Mob Rules lineup back, and it goes that well that they decide to go back into the studio as Heaven and Hell. And in 2009, we get a new album called The Devil You Know, and a tour to support that as well. Yeah, what's your thoughts on The Devil You Know, Mike?
Okay. A lot of this, the same old Dio lyrical stylings. Bible Black is a cool tune on that album.
Yeah, it's decent.
It's got the acoustic intro to it. And it's pretty long. It's long getting into, But I don't know. That's the one song on there that one of the songs, I guess. I don't even know what else I would recommend on that.
Yeah, I did quite enjoy it, but I guess because I was listening to everything through in chronological order, by the time I got to this, I'd listened to an awful lot of absolute rubbish. So it was kind of like an oasis.
Yeah.
Thirsty Man at the Oasis. I was like, oh man, just yes, please, thank you. Okay, let's have a little bit of Bible Black, and then we'll wrap up with getting to the end of things with Black Sabbath. I mean, yeah, compared to No Stranger to Love, I mean, it's like...
Definitely got that Sabbath feel to it, especially when the riffs kick in.
Yeah, I think you're right. I did listen to this album a couple of times, went back to it, you know, in sort of preparation for this, and yeah, it's perhaps not as good as I first thought it was, because it was just such a relief after just the non-stop diet of dross that I'd been served up. So that album comes out in 2009. There's a tour to support that. At this point, Ronnie James Dio is not well, and turns out he's terminally ill, and in 2010 he sadly dies, sort of closing the chapter on the Heaven and Hell era of Black Sabbath, which means, unsurprisingly, with Ronnie safely out the way, from Sharon's point of view, in 2011 the original lineup reforms, and a new album is announced with Rick Rubin producing again, but then the following year, 2012, before any of that can happen, Tony gets diagnosed with cancer, and so that kind of puts a whole new slant on everything. But just when we get the original lineup back together, Bill drops out saying that he's not willing to sign the contract that he's been presented to be part of Black Sabbath again. So the band headline Download, which is the big metal festival in the UK, used to be called Monsters of Rock back in the 80s. And Tommy Kalfitos in Ozzy's band fills in on drums, with Bill being out of the picture. And these shows were kind of potentially billed as this could be the end of Black Sabbath because of Tony's cancer situation. And by all accounts, the download performance was pretty epic. The weather was horrendous. They had to shorten it was like absolute mud bath. They had to shorten because the weather was that bad. They shortened the amount of acts that were playing for safety reasons, you know, to try and keep things under control. But so they play that, and then the following year, 2013, we get the unimaginatively titled album 13, which isn't their 13th album.
Yeah, that's the confusing part of it.
But because Bill is out of the picture and we don't have Tommy Clafoutis on drums, we have Brad Wilk of Rage Against the Machine and Audio Slave on drums. Yeah, what's your thoughts on the 13 album, Mike?
It was a pleasant surprise, to be honest with you. When it first came out, I wasn't expecting a whole lot. And I was on Bill's side when the whole controversy about, you know, the contract and all that. I was rooting for Bill. But, you know, Brad Wilk, if you're going to grab somebody, you may as well grab, you know, one of the best drummers, one of the best bands out there. Two of the best bands out there, really. I mean, Audioslave and Rage. But, yeah, it was that was a good album. I mean, and it, you know, and not only that, it went to number one, both in the US and the UK, which is amazing.
Yeah, I think, I'll be honest with you, I actually prefer Del Vino to this. That, yeah, I mean, the hype around this was quite high at the time.
There was.
And I do remember back then, so I can't remember what podcast it was. I didn't stick with it, but it was some well-known American metal DJ. And him and another guy, they were allowed to listen to the album and talk about it, but they weren't allowed to play anything from it. So you had the bizarre situation of them describing what this sounded like. And I'm like, what is going on? Why aren't we? Anyway, yeah, I don't think I quite enjoyed this as much as you did, Mike. Because to me, let's get the good things. It at least sounds like a Black Sabbath album.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it sounds like Black Sabbath. What I would say is, it does feel a little bit like ChatGPT was asked to make a Black Sabbath album.
Before ChatGPT was even around.
If we could send that back in the DeLorean to 2013. I mean, compared to like Forbidden or Born Again, it's masterful, but I think it misses having Bill. It doesn't quite, it doesn't have that looseness that Bill would have brought to it, I think. Yeah, that we talked about previously. And I think also, I know that they obviously multi-track Ozzy's vocals a lot during a lot of his, throughout his entire career, but it sounds like they took the processing a little bit too far on this one as well.
Yeah, I can see that.
The vocal process, it's like, and it tips it over the edge into being a bit too much for me, but yes, compared to what we've had previously, it's, I mean, it's night and day difference. You got any particular favorites on there you want to?
The only one that I really, really have a knowledge of is God Is Dead. You know, the one that won the Grammy for him.
Yeah, I mean, that would be my pick as well, certainly, of what's on there. So, although, again, just shows the worthlessness of the Grammys, really, because if this is the... this is the song you're giving Black Sabbath a Grammy for, you've missed the boat, haven't you, really?
Yep. Yeah. I think it was a sympathy Grammy.
Yeah, it's like Metallica, wasn't it, when they finally gave him a Grammy. It's like, it's only, or Scorsese with the Oscar for Departed. It's like, yeah, okay, it's fine, but it's far too late.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's have a little snippet of God Is Dead, and then we'll wrap things up.
Thank you. A rather long song, which is kind of surprising as a single.
Yeah, when it's such a long song to sort of get a nice little snippet of it. But you can see what I mean about Ozzy's vocals there.
Yeah, after you mentioned it and listening to it now, I can definitely hear the processing going on there.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what to my ears makes it, when I said it's like an AI version of a Black Sabbath album, that heavily processed part of it is what kind of gives it that sort of feel, I think, compared to how organic those early albums sound by comparison,
Right.
You're not getting this sort of the emotion in Ozzy's voice. It's kind of like squashed by all the digitalness on top of it, But, say, compared to what we've had, we'll be grateful for Small Mercies. So, as you said, it was a big success sales-wise, and they announced another Rick Rubin album in 2014 to be made. That never happened, so that gets canned in 2016 when the end tour is announced. So the final Black Sabbath tour, still with this lineup with Brad Wilk, is announced. And Black Sabbath play their final show, people will be surprised to know, in 2017. And there's a live album of that as well. And things go quiet on the Black Sabbath front. Until obviously earlier this year, when the final show was announced, the Back to Beginning, which Hands of Brittany obviously did a great job of relaying their experience of that and that performance in the All Star lineup, and then sadly on the 22nd of July this year, Ozzy passed away. And as far as Black Sabbath goes, that will now, I'm sure, be that, other than stuff, anything that's in the archives that's not yet been put out,
Glenn Hughes is still recording.
Yes. Ian Gillan is still alive.
Ian Gillan's still out there.
Yeah, Ian Gillan probably should stick to Deep Purple, but, I mean, the things with Glenn Hughes, going back to that, I mean, I think we'll maybe just throw these in today. I mean, Geezer puts out another two solo albums, one in 97, called Black Science, and another in 2005 called Homework, which are both similar vein to what we heard earlier. Pretty heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But Tony Iommi has a few solo, actual proper solo releases that come out. In 96, talking of Glenn Hughes, he goes into the studio, Depth Studios, to record an album with Glenn Hughes. But that falls foul of the reunion, so that sits that exists only as a bootleg between 96 and 2004.
Four is when that was released.
Yeah, and wittily, the bootleggers called that Eighth Star. It's the sequel to Seventh Star. But it does finally get a release in 2004 as the Depth Sessions. And it's pretty decent, actually. I really like it. Because it's not a Black Sabbath album, because it's a Tony Hughes... Glenn Hughes... We've been talking about this too long, Mike. All the names are getting mixed up. It's a Glenn Hughes, Tony Iommi duo project. Because it's not trying to be Black Sabbath, it can just be a really good hard rock album, which is what it is.
Right.
They also put out an album in 2005 called Fused, which... is again a Glenn Hughes and Tony Iommi project, which is also very good. I would certainly recommend either of those two to any of the listeners wanting to, just some really good hard rock. Yeah, because Glenn Hughes sounds great, and because it's not Sabbath, it doesn't have that weight of expectation and burden, and it can, and the fact that it's doing hard rock things and it's doing alternative rock things. it's perfectly fine.
Yeah. He doesn't have the interference from the labels and the management to make it a Sabbath album.
Yes, exactly. It's just them just doing their thing, and it's pretty good, you know. And I really enjoyed both of them. I actually listened to them multiple times, you know, because it's just like, yeah, this is good stuff. There was also a Tanya Iommi solo album came out in 2000, just called Iommi, with a number of different guest vocalists. Now, for whatever reason, that is not on the streamings. It is on YouTube if you want to seek it out.
I think I have that CD, actually.
Got a who's who of vocalists on it. I think I probably enjoyed the Dave Grohl and the Billy Idol tracks the most myself. I don't know if you've got a pick on that, Mike, but...
I do not have a take on that.
No. It's decent. I if you're looking for the solo, it's inverted commas, solo stuff, I would point folks towards, say, either the Fused or the Depth Sessions with Glenn Hughes as being, good stuff.
Yeah, I have to look into that. I have it on CD somewhere in my stacks of CDs. I'll have to dig it out.
Yeah, it's pretty good. So there we go. So we've reached the end of day three, Mike, and we've reached our end of talking specifically about Black Sabbath. Any final thoughts you want to share on that before we close things out?
Sabbath is Sabbath. They created a whole genre, and they've influenced millions of musicians. And just gathering from the family tree and the influences that they've had over the years, it's amazing what they've been able to accomplish despite all the setbacks they had throughout their lives and careers. And this has been fun so far.
Only now, I think, with all these Ozzy's death, that sort of their legacy is getting reappraised and put into its right place because of all what happened in the 80s. You know, it devalued it so much that they were almost like an afterthought, you know, even in metal circles, really.
Yeah, it was kind of sad.
You compare particularly, especially to like Led Zeppelin, with how Jimmy Page in particular sort of protected the legacy of Led Zeppelin through the 80s, you know, with, you know, there wasn't, whilst he wanted to keep Led Zeppelin going, it wasn't going to be called Led Zeppelin unless it was... Led Zeppelin, you know,
mm-hmm.
He did, yeah. And so whilst, okay, the final two Led Zeppelin albums aren't as good as the rest, you know, their legacy was held sort of much more intact because it was kind of preserved, you know, much like bands like The Clash, for example, you know, because there was no kind of going back. It was kind of like, here it is.
Yeah.
And we're going to do other things, you know.
Yep.
And I think it's taken until sort of this length of time to pass for that sort of that bad 80s smell to get washed away.
That's a good way to describe it. But, long overdue appreciation is now finally been given to them. And it's very cool to see there. I mean, you mentioned the name Ozzy. Everybody knows, you don't have to say his last name. You mentioned the name Ozzy. Everybody from grandmothers to young kids know who Ozzy Osbourne was. And, you know, obviously a lot of that has to do with stuff that he did after, you know, and with his TV show and whatnot. But Ozzy is just, he's just one of those one-named people that everybody knows.
Indeed. And we'll get into that more tomorrow when we'll cover the career of John Michael Osbourne. Right then, Mike, pick a Sabbath tune that we haven't played that you'd like to play out with to wrap up these.
Can we play something from the Iommi?
Yeah, we'll play out with Into the Night by... Is that okay, Mike, for going out?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it for today. We'll play out with Tony Iommi and Billy Idol doing Into the Night, and we will talk to you all tomorrow for Ozzy Osbourne Day in Black Sabbath Week.
And you're living in the dark forever, in your own little private.